You know what's great about the Volkswagen Sign and Drive event? No matter how you sign your name, you can get a great deal on select 2018 Volkswagen models. Sign perfectly neat, you get a great deal. Sign super messy, get a great deal. Sign outside the lines. Do one of those fancy weird signatures where your nine-letter last name looks like a half a V. You still get a great deal on models like the all-new Tiguan SUV or fun-to-drive Jetta. So practice your signature. Then head over to your nearest Volkswagen dealer for the Sign Then Drive event, going on now for a limited time.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, I have attention deficit disorder, which I describe to people who don't have this as being like trying to think while being attacked by a flock of crows. So, as I've written in my advice column, ADHD is idiotically named. People who have it don't have a deficit of attention. They have too much attention to everything. What we lack is a cognitive cruise director to get our errant thoughts to sit down and shut up so we can pay attention to one at a time. This can sometimes make it really hard to sit at a computer and focus on a paragraph, but in ancestral terms, I have a AAA top-grade brain, one that can pay attention to lots of things all at the same time. There's the salad, watch out for the raccoon, don't let the baby wander off the cliff. So only a few of you listening have ADHD, but what we all have in common is that our thinking can often be out of step for our times. My guest tonight, evolutionary psychologist and psychology and marketing professor Dr. Vladis Riskevicius, has come up with ways to help us be more in step with our times, to make wiser decisions, and to understand when we're being driven by thinking that's outmoded for our goals. He's authored a brilliant book with a fellow evolutionary psychologist, Dr. Douglas Kenrick, and it is The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think. Stick with us and learn how you can control your impulses instead of letting them control you. Hello, Vlad.
Hi, Amy. Pleasure to be on.
I'm so glad you're here. Now, you start your book by asking a question, are our decisions rational or irrational? And then you give some examples. There's a guy who spent $785,000 on a Cadillac with gold-plated hubcaps and 40 coats of paint from pearls, oriental fish scales, and diamond dust. Then you give the example of a New Yorker who works as a superintendent of an apartment building who spent all of his savings on lottery tickets, has not won, continues to spend $30,000 a year on these without ever hitting it big. And now you give the example of an immigrant from a poor communist country who once stood in line for 4 hours to buy his first banana. This immigrant lands in America, is taken to a supermarket, and buys a surprising thing. So tell us about the last story, because that's your story.
Well, that last one sounds very familiar to me because it's my story. It was actually my very first choice that I ever made as a capitalist American when I was taken off the plane coming from Soviet Lithuania at the time. And my relative took me from the plane straight to a supermarket and said I could have anything I wanted from the store. And, you know, and I was looking at all these products going, oh my God, there's so many options. I've never seen so many options in my life. But at the end of the day, what I ended up choosing was a pack of Bubblicious watermelon bubble gum. And that was my first purchase as an American.
Why did you buy that?
You know, that's kind of what I'm studying. Where at the time, I remember being so overwhelmed by the options that I had in front of me, where it was thousands and tens of thousands of things I could have bought. Imagine if someone asked you, you could have any single thing, you pick out that what thing. And that's actually what I study in my research, is why do people choose the things they choose and all the things that happen subconsciously to influence those choices.
And now you talk about how our ancestral environment created the psychology we pretty much are dealing with today. And just to go off that example, we wouldn't have had a zillion choices in the ancestral environment. It might have been raspberry or blackberry if you were lucky. So our minds really aren't set up for the modern grocery store.
Yeah, not at all. The modern environment is very different than the environment not just hundreds of thousands of years ago, even 100 or 200 years ago, where supermarkets didn't exist. But the key thing to understand is that the brain we have in our modern skulls is essentially a Stone Age brain. The brain hasn't changed that much, but the environment around us has changed that much. So when we make a choice in the modern environment, the key is to understand how our ancestral brain makes those choices, because that's the brain that's making those choices for us today.
And so one of the contentions you make in the book is that when we see some what we perceive as stupid decisions by ourselves or others, that they're not really stupid, they're ancestrally driven.
You know, the way I think about it is I think about it as puzzles. People do puzzling things all the time, and especially when you look at the way they spend their money or spend their time, they do weird things like spend $30,000 on the lottery. And the way we approach puzzles in this book is we looked at it the same way that Charles Darwin looked at whenever he saw a puzzling trait or a puzzling behavior. Take something like the peacock's tail. Why the heck would the peacock's tail exist? It's really bright and really big, so your enemies can see it from miles away and say, oh, there's my peacock dinner. And at the same time, when you start running away from those predators, it slows you down. That thing weighs 5 pounds. Well, Darwin said this is a puzzle. Why would it exist if natural selection didn't, if it doesn't help survival? Well, we do the same thing to human behaviors, where we turn that lens onto human puzzles and say, why would anyone spend $30,000 on the lottery? Because they do.
And now, one way to look at human decision-making is through rational economics. And economists view people as rational, and any decision boils down to the question, what's it worth to me? But you actually look at how our judgments and decisions are irrational, but they make sense in terms of our ancestral environment and our evolutionary psychology. And you give the example of two people waiting in line to see a movie. And you say, person A gets the ticket window. He's told he's the millionth customer. He gets $100. Person B is at a different theater. He gets the ticket window. He's told that the person in front of him is the millionth customer and wins $1 million. And then he gets $150 for being the person right after the millionth customer. And so, you know, you'd think that the person would, you know, say, oh, I'll take the $150, you know, for being the person behind the person who got $1 million, but they actually don't do that.
Right. So what you're describing is this idea called loss aversion. It's this weird human bias that people have where losses feel larger than gains, where people are really reluctant to lose something, and they feel a lot worse than they gain something of equal value. It's like when you lose $20, it feels very bad. When you find $20, it feels nice, but not as positive as losing, as when you lose it, the equivalent amount. And the idea here is that this has been deemed to be irrational. Humans show these biases, and it's yet another example of how we're irrational, we're kind of weird, we're just people, we're flawed in many ways. But if you take this Charles Darwin approach and say, well, why would the human brain come equipped to have this bias? The likelihood that it's there because we're simply dumb is unlikely. Instead, there's probably some reason. And in fact, if you look at monkeys, there's a study done at Yale a few years ago that discovered that monkeys show the exact same bias. And so why would human brains, monkey brains, come equipped with this thing? Well, chances are there's something deeper going on. There's a reason why our ancestors might have benefited from being loss averse.
Can you give an example of how?
Well, if you think about it, let's go back to the past, just like we talked earlier, where what is the environment in which our brains evolved? And in that environment, we did not have supermarkets. We did not have steak dinners or pasta dinners ready to go every single night. Instead, we're living at the margins. We're living in times of scarcity and in times when what you have, if you lose it, that's the difference between life and death. And gaining a little bit extra is not nearly as positive as losing something that you have. And in that kind of environment, individuals who were not loss averse, who didn't feel real pain when they had losses, well, they're not the ones who became our ancestors. Our ancestors thrived because they were the ones who were loss averse.
Right. It's very protective. And you give an example of a smoke detector that keeps going off. And he wanted to, the guy wanted to adjust the sensitivity. And his daughter said, but Daddy, what if there's a fire and the alarm doesn't sound? And that's just such a great example of what you're talking about.
That's right. I mean, think about your smoke detectors, where that's a really nice way to think about how the human brain is wired to make decisions. Where if a smoke detector, you have to make a yes or no decision. Is there smoke in our environment, or is there no smoke in our environment? That's what the smoke detector says. Yes, yes, bleep, 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 there's smoke, or no, don't worry, it's safe. But it never has complete information. It never has perfect information. It has to be biased one way or another. And most people generally want their smoke detectors to be biased, to be overly sensitive, to ring the alarm even when there might not be a fire, rather than to miss the fire, not ring the alarm when there is one. And our brains do the same exact thing. We make errors. We make errors just like smoke detectors do, but those errors are there because there's a smart error to make to prevent us from making the larger mistake, to literally be burned alive some of the time.
Well, I like how you said that, the smart error to make. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is evolutionary psychologist and psychology and marketing professor, Dr. Vladas Griskevicius. His book, co-authored with fellow evolutionary psychologist Douglas Kenrick, is The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think. And I'm very interested in these errors, these smart errors. One of them I write about in my column has been error management theory. You write about this. Men have a sexual overperception bias. They're more likely to see women's interests where none exists. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. So this is, if anyone's been on the dating scene, you've probably witnessed guys where whenever a woman might do so much as look her way or look his way, the guy thinks that, no, she probably really wants me. And over again, guys are wrong about this, where women are not that interested in most men, and yet guys think that women are interested in them. And you can see, look at this in the same way as the smoke detector example, where a guy could make two types of errors. One of the errors he could make is that a woman is not interested in him, but he thinks that she's interested in him. You know, I think she wants me, and I can tell. Well, that's an error. It's a wrong error. He could also make a different type of error, a much costlier error, is that a woman is interested in him, but he doesn't see that interest. And that second error would be much more costlier in evolutionary terms, because guys don't actually get that many mating opportunities. And missing a mating opportunity is like being caught in a burning building from an evolutionary sense. That is not the error you want to make. And what ends up happening is men's brains are biased to make the other type of error, to overperceive the sexual interest.
And now women, on the other hand, make a different kind of error. They have commitment skepticism bias. Yeah, you give me roses. Sure, you know, you're really interested in committing. You just want a one-night stand, is what women are thinking.
That's right. And women are very wise to not overperceive interest, but to say, you know, I don't think you're gonna follow through with what you're saying. I'm very skeptical about your intentions. In fact, there's a study we talk about in the book where the question is, when in relationships do men and women profess their love for their partner? You know, how soon is it in relationships, and who does it first? Is it men or is it women? And people commonly think that, well, women are the mushy ones. They're the ones who should be professing love early on. They talk about romantic things, and guys don't do these things. Completely not true. Men say I love you more than 30 days earlier in relationships than women. And as you could understand, women should be skeptical when men say these kinds of things, because it might not really be love. It might be more about lust.
Right. And also, we forgot to mention that women, the reason they have this commitment skepticism bias and men have this sexual overperception bias is because of paternity uncertainty in men, paternal, how much investment each sex has to make in paternity. A guy can have sex with a woman and just walk away, and a woman could get pregnant from a single sex act. And back then, 1.8 million years ago, you didn't really want to be wandering around the Sahara when there were no 7-Elevens or Motel 6s or even rubber-soled shoes.
And that's right. The act of having sex with someone, it has much more potential cost to a woman, because she's the one who could end up pregnant, and you know, what does the guy do? He's not going to be the one who's carrying the baby. So you're absolutely right. There's a big difference between men and women there.
And this is why it's so helpful that your book, The Rational Animal, talks about how we need to look at human behavior through an evolutionary lens. And you talk about, this is so fascinating, the seven sub-selves, that we have these, we are different people, or you have different goals based on what the context is, the thing that we're presented with, the thing, what are we going to have to decide about. And I want to let you start talking about with this great story you tell about Martin Luther King.
Well, one thing that happens to people is that they're often perceived to be hypocrites. Where in one situation a person does one thing, and in a different situation a person does something else. And this is really strange types of behavior where people go back on their word. And you look at this puzzle from a Darwinian perspective and go, well, why would people do different things in different situations? And from an evolutionary perspective, that's a pretty simple answer. They're trying to achieve different evolutionary goals in different situations. Sometimes they might be trying to attract a mate. Other times they might be caring about their survival and trying to protect themselves. Still other times they might be trying to rise up the hierarchy. And their behaviors are going to change depending on which particular goal they have. It's as though they're going to have a different personality depending on the underlying evolutionary goal that's currently driving their behavior.
And so just about this Martin Luther King story, it's so fascinating. You talk about how he just basically stood there. Somebody punched him, and he just stood there and said, we're going to pray for the guy, which is not my way of getting out of a nose punch. But then, and he was so committed to nonviolence that he took this route. But then when it came to extramarital affairs, he ran around a lot. And so you talk about how he had a different, basically sub-self going on. And I want you to talk about sub-self that we have. You say we have seven different sub-selves, and they work toward different goals. So self-protection, disease avoidance, affiliation, meaning, you know, your community, your team, the status, our seeking status, mate retention, mate acquisition, kin care, which is family, nurturing parent, and all of these, when you're presented with a choice, that which one of these is primed to deal with that choice makes a difference in how you respond.
That's absolutely right, where we often think about a person as just being one person. It's intuitive that you are who you are wherever you are. But what research has shown is that that's not the case. Who you are changes depending on where you are and on who you're with. And so what we find is that these different sub-selves, which are like people's different personalities, can be brought out in different situations. For instance, like when you're watching a TV show and you see a commercial, how you are going to see that ad depends on the kind of TV program that you're watching. If you're watching something that's perhaps a romantic comedy, it might bring out your mate acquisition sub-self. This is the one that's driven to attract potential mates. But if you're watching a different program, like CSI or something that has criminals running around, well, this might activate a self-protection sub-self, one who's motivated to protect oneself from danger. And then how you're going to see that ad, whether you're going to like it or you're going to be repulsed by it, depends literally on what is your goal at that time, which sub-self has been brought out in you by your social situation.
So it's not necessarily the goal that you think is your goal. It's the one that has been brought out because you're watching a scary movie. So you're self-protective, for example. And you actually give this great example of an ad that there's a cafe described two ways. Truly a one-of-a-kind place that has yet to be discovered by others. That's one description. And then the other description given to some of the other people in the study is a place over 1 million people have eaten. If you want to know why everyone gathers here for a great dining experience, come join all these people. And you had, or I don't know if this is your study, but the study subject, some viewed a clip from The Shining, which is really terrifying. Other viewed a clip from the romantic comedy Before Sunset, and people who went to the scary movie wanted to go where all the millions of people went, and people with the romantic movie wanted to go to the really unique place. Now tell us why that is.
Right, so it was actually a study that both me and Doug Kenrick, who's a co-author of the book, we conducted a few years ago, And the idea is a very simple one, where there are two types of persuasion strategies that are very often used, where one of them is this conforming strategy that says, you know, here's what everyone else is doing. This is the best-selling product. Over a million people have bought this thing. Another type of strategy is a uniqueness strategy, saying this is a one-of-a-kind product. It'll help you stand out from the crowd. It's a limited edition version. And the question is, which of these is more effective? And I work at a business school. I teach marketing classes. And there's a very simple answer to that question. It depends on the person. Some people are the conformist sort, and they'll be influenced by the conforming strategy. Other people are the uniqueness sort. They want to stand out from the crowd. Well, what we find in the study, and what we show over and over again in the book through multiple studies, is that that's not the case. It's not just that some people conform and other people want to stand out. It depends on which subset is currently drawn out in you. Sometimes the same person wants to stand out, and sometimes the same person wants to fit in, depending on the evolutionary goal that they're currently pursuing at that time. And that's exactly what's being drawn out by the TV show that you might be watching before you see one of those two ads.
That's so fascinating. And I want to tell everybody listening, by the end of the show, we're going to give you some tips about how you can control your responses and not be played on by the context that you're in. And so I want to talk about family. You say we play a very different game than rational economics when it comes to family, or even what seems like family. And you talk about the story of the Disney brothers, Roy O. Disney and Walt Disney, and Walt was this big spendthrift. Okay, I'm going to spend all this money on animation, extravagant stuff. And Roy was kind of peeved about this, but they were brothers, so they managed their differences.
Yeah, and it's really an old story of how the Disney company got started, which is two brothers working with each other and tolerating each other, arguing a lot, but sticking through thick and thin. And then what happened to the Disney company later? So in 1984, Michael Eisner is brought in to be the CEO of Disney. And he has a very different approach to running a company. It's much more of a Wall Street approach. And even though one of the Disneys had actually brought Eisner in, several decades later, they were at each other's throats. They could not agree on anything, and they had a bitter divorce that cost them not just their friendship, but cost a lot of money. And so it's an important lesson to be learned about running a family business and not a family business, and there's a lot of important evolutionary principles involved in the differences between the two.
And you give the example of Southwest Airlines as a company that's run like a family, and that makes a big difference in employee behavior.
That's right. Where the key difference in the family business is that because from an evolutionary perspective, you are related to the other person. Even if the other person wins out over you, if you're having a disagreement, you can still win by losing that disagreement. In other words, think about if your brother succeeds at something and you fail at something, you succeed vicariously through your brother because you share genes with your own brother. And that's the case of Walt Disney and Roy Disney. Whereas if you're not related to the other person, it's a zero-sum game. It means that one person's going to win and the other person is completely going to lose in that situation. And an important lesson from this is that any business could be run more like a family or more like a corporation. And it could be run more like a family even if you're not running that business with family, which is exactly what Southwest Airlines did, where they constantly drew out these subcells, the family kin care subcells and other people, to treat employees, each other, like family members, and to make sacrifices in tough times and actually become an extremely successful company.
Yeah, it's counterintuitive, but it really, really makes sense. And you show countless examples of this. And I love this study Lisa Breen did, a way to convert strangers into kin, that people trusted people in this economist game. They give money to divide between two people in a lab. And then when the photo of the person was morphed with that of another person, then they trusted that person, and they were more likely, I think, to share the money.
Right, and the idea here is that when you're dealing with someone who's a stranger, you're not likely to trust that stranger very much. And when you don't trust the other person, there's a mistrusting psychology, everyone ends up losing with each other. But in the study, what Lisa De Bruin did is she morphed your own face into the other person, and now you're looking at this other person, and he kind of looks like your long-lost brother. You can't tell that you're inside that other person, but the psychology of family relations, that kincare sub-self, is being activated because you're subconsciously seeing yourself in that other person. And all of a sudden, you begin to trust that other person more, and it makes for much more smoother interaction, and it makes for one where everybody ends up winning in the end.
And now you talk about UCLA's Alan Fisk, who believes that the human mind has separate systems for calculating exchanges. And we talked about the communal sharing model that's used between relatives. And there's the cold-blooded market pricing. And then there's another model, equality matching, and it describes exchanges between peers and friends. And you talk about Lennon and McCartney and Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. And that they feel it's fair when everyone gets the same amount, but once there's imbalance, that tends to break up partnerships and cause imbalance and cause resentment.
That's absolutely. And Alan Fisk, the person who did all this fabulous research, he's an anthropologist who studied different cultures. And this is 20 years ago that he realized that there is not just one single set of rules that people use to deal with each other. That the world is not exactly how economists have described it for years, which is that, well, everyone is just rational and everyone's in it to get the most for themselves. Instead, people have different rules for dealing with their friends, for dealing with their family members, for dealing with their bosses, or for dealing with someone who's haggling over a used car. And the idea that Alan Fisk had that he saw across cultures is very similar to the idea that Doug and I have been thinking about, which is that evolutionary subcells, these different personalities, where some of the rules that Alan Fisk described are precisely the rules that each of our subcells uses when dealing with other people, including like the one you just mentioned, which is how we deal with our friends.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. When we come back, we're going to talk about whether Ecuadorian tribesmen or Harvard students have a better ability to reason. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking tonight with Dr. Vladis Griskavicius. His book, co-authored with fellow evolutionary psychologist Dr. Douglas Kenrick, is The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think, and it's really good and really well written and funny, too. So I recommend it. So, okay, about the Harvard students. Who has a better ability to reason? This is Larry Sugiyama's research. He's an anthropologist, and he studies the Ecuadorian Shuar tribe. So Harvard students or Ecuadorian Shuars?
Well, that's a loaded question that you're asking me here. But what Larry Sugiyama found, and this was fascinating to me the first time I read this, is he was doing work at Harvard and giving Harvard students a logical test. It was a very difficult test. And then he started doing some field work in Ecuador studying the Shuar, and he wanted to know, would these folks do on that same exact test that he had been given to the Harvard students? And I presume quite a bit to his surprise that people in the Amazon, those who didn't have any years of formal education, actually just slightly outperformed the Harvard students, which was amazing that this could actually happen.
So does this tell us that helicopter parents need to send their kids to the Ecuadorian jungle?
Well, it does tell you that paying a lot of money for an education is going to buy you some things, but it's not going to fundamentally change your brain, where we are who we are. And one of the things that Larry Sugiyama learned in this research and he told the rest of the world about is that sometimes when we see people struggling, when we see people doing irrational things, it's not so much that the people themselves are not very smart or need more training, but it's that the questions, the way they're being asked, are not tapping our very intelligent brains.
And there's a term that I've learned called evolutionarily novel. And can you explain that and how that relates to what you're just talking about?
Evolutionarily novel describes any situation that we might encounter today that we would not have encountered over evolutionary history. So when I think of evolutionarily novel, I think of the idea of talking as opposed to the idea of writing. And talking is something that our ancestors have been doing for a very long time. And because we've been doing it for a long time, talking comes easily. I have three little kids at home, and they just start talking. They don't need formal instruction. If they're surrounded by televisions that talk or they hang around the kitchen, they'll learn to talk. But at the same time, they are not going to learn to write unless someone sits down and teaches them how to write and what these symbols mean. And that's because writing is a very new idea in evolutionary history. We have not been writing for a long time, and even in the last 1,000 years, a very tiny percentage of people have been writing. And so talking, something evolutionarily old, is easy, and it comes to us very simply. Writing is very difficult. I teach college classes, and I reckon I'm never going to hear that college students write well. Everyone always complains how poorly they write, and these people have been instructed in writing for 12 years.
Well, let me just say, it's a joy when professors write well. Luckily, you're one of those. So
Tina, my great irony, you know, professors can't even write. What's going on? Well, writing is just that difficult.
Yeah, some people, I'll just say that some people just think that they're done before they're done. And I'm talking with Dr. Vladas Griskovicius. His book, The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think, co-authored with Douglas T. Kenrick. It's really good. And so about evolutionarily novel environments, it turns out even animals have these problems now. And it gives this great example of the supposedly suicidal turtles who laid their eggs on asphalt in the middle of the path of oncoming 18-wheelers.
Right, so this is in the middle of Florida, where I actually found this newspaper article talking about how to help suicidal turtles, and a person in Florida had taken upon himself to do something about these suicidal turtles who were behaving completely irrationally. And what was going on is that when turtles are born, so they hatch on beaches, this little tiny turtles come out of eggs, and they're supposed to go towards the ocean. They're supposed to go to the water. And the way that they figure out where to go when this little tiny baby hatches is they look up at the sky. They hatch at the nighttime, and up at the sky, they're looking for little bright lights. And those bright lights are the stars above the ocean, as opposed to looking the other way where you might see trees or something else. So they've evolved to walk towards these bright little lights. And what was happening in Florida is that when they hatch, they look for where the bright lights are, and most of the bright lights in this Florida city were not on the ocean, they were on the other side, where all these fancy hotels were being built, and they were very sparkly with their bright windows, and all the turtles, instead of going to the ocean, were going across the road to the hotel, and they were getting crushed by cars in the process, or committing suicide after birth.
This is so awful. And did they solve that problem there? Did they put up a fence or something?
I think he fought very hard, and what he did is he put little blocks around the lights, so when the turtles are born, they don't directly see the lights. But the turtle metaphor is applying to all of our modern life today, with the idea that things that are evolutionary novel. Turtles are not inherently irrational. They are born using ideas, using cues that have worked very well for millennia. Look up at the sky and crawl wherever there are lights. But the modern environment has completely changed life for them. Now when they look up at the sky and they see the lights, they crawl to death rather than crawl to the ocean. And that's often what's happening to us humans today in the modern world, where we're surrounded by things that our mind has never seen before. And we're using the same ancestral brain to process these novel things. And oftentimes it can make us look very, very stupid. But it's not because we're actually stupid. It's because a lot of our modern world isn't tapping our deeper evolutionary intelligence.
Now, you have this great chapter on modern cavemen, and basically over and over show how that we are really bad at dealing with complicated math problems, but that the way we can deal with them is to think of these problems in terms of the simple evolutionary environment, where the questions were, will I pass on my genes? Will I get cheated out of a piece of that bison? And Lita Cosmides, who's a UCSB evolutionary psychologist, she found that people who can't solve certain logic problems can solve them just fine when they make the problems about detecting someone who's cheating them.
Right. So Lita Cosmides, one of the founders of evolutionary psychology, took this insanely complex logical problem that people had a very hard time solving. In fact, students at Harvard solved this problem 12% of the time. In the Amazon, they solved this problem 0% of the time. So this is not where they're shining. And this was used to say, look, people, they just can't reason well. We need to give them, take them to school. We need to give them more education so they can solve this complicated problem. If they only figured out how to deduce logically, they would be able to solve it. Well, what Lita saw is that the same exact logic required to solve that problem is something that our ancestors have been using for years, for thousands of years, to solve another problem, and that's to detect the cheaters in our mix, to figure out who are the friends around us or other people around us who are stealing from us, who are taking more than we want to give them. And when she gave people the same exact problem, but merely changed the language to reflect cheaters instead of this weird abstract conditional logic, all of a sudden, Harvard students solved it 82% of the time, and people in the jungles of the Amazon solved it 83% of the time when they solved 0% of the time when the problem was phrased in this abstract, weird way.
I love that. And then you give another one, and I can actually say his name better than I can say yours. Gerd Gegerenzer, who's a decision scientist at Max Planck in Germany, you know, he sees that people have a real hard time when you say, okay, well, what's the numerical percentage of this thing? He thinks it's out of sync for the brain in an ordinary person, but sees that people do really well when statistical problems are presented in terms of what are called natural frequencies. And you give the example of the shuar chief in Ecuador trying to decide whether he should go hunting this canyon, and he thinks, well, like the last 5 out of 20 hunts, we caught some food there.
Right, and so Gerd Gegerenzer is a very smart guy who's been aware of this idea that our modern our brains are mismatched to our environment. And a great example that he's been using for years is this idea of natural frequencies. How do we present numbers in the modern world? And we're inundated with numbers. And even though we take years and years of math classes, people still get a little bit weird when they see things like 0.075 probability or 0.072 likelihood. Now, we've been taught what that means, but what exactly does it mean again? And what Gerd Gegerenzer does is translates those same exact numbers into something that our brain can much easily understand, saying things like, well, 7 out of 100 people say this, instead of there's a 0.07 probability of something happening. And as soon as he makes these little translations, people all of a sudden start looking like savants, where problems that they couldn't solve before, problems that were too difficult, now they're getting it right almost every single time.
You give the example, too, of doctors who couldn't figure out breast cancer probabilities, but then if you presented that same way, and like you said, to solve problems, to think of it in simple terms that we would have dealt with in evolutionary times, how many people out of 100, et cetera, that these allow people to make the proper calculations.
And the doctor problem you bring up is just shocking to me, where Gegerenzer found real doctors and gave them a question that presented some statistical information, and the question was, if a woman tests positive for breast cancer, how likely is it that she actually has breast cancer? And he gave all the statistics that you need. And the answers just varied wildly. Some doctors said it was 90%, some doctors said it was 10%. These are huge differences, and only 21% of the doctors actually got the question right. Now, that's scary. These are actual trained gynecologists getting that answer right 21% of the time. But when all he did is he tweaked those numbers and how he presented the statistics up front and turned them into natural frequencies, the frequency that our ancestral brain can much more easily receive, all of a sudden almost 90% of the doctors just instantly got the right answer.
It's so, so amazing. When we come back, we're going to talk about why people go from rags to riches and then end up in bankruptcy court. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking with Dr. Vladas Griskevicius. His book, co-authored with fellow evolutionary psychologist Dr. Douglas Kenrick, is The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think, and I recommend it because it will help you make smarter decisions by understanding how we make decisions in different contexts. Okay, so you give the example of MC Hammer as a guy who went from rags to riches, really incredible. It had maybe $33 million as estimated by Fortune magazine, but then not only lost his fortune, but ended up $13 million in debt. And this is apparently very, very, it happens often with these people with the rags to riches stories.
It happens quite a bit when people who come into a lot of money feel the urge to spend that money quickly. Patrick Ewing, former center of the New York Knicks, a great center, just said it very simply. He said, we make a lot of money, but we spend a lot of money too. And not everyone feels that urge to spend a lot of money when you come into that money. But people who go from rags to riches are especially likely to want to spend that money rather than save it, like MC Hammer did.
And now what explains this is something called life history theory, and it's about trade-offs. And can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, what's critical for people in this case is their childhood environment. And the idea that saving money isn't always the smartest thing. Now, from an economic perspective, you should want to save money. You should want to prepare yourself for the future. But for animals, it's not always the smartest thing. It depends on the kind of environment you live in. And in some types of environments, such as ones that are very dangerous, that are very unpredictable, saving for the future is unwise because you might not be around to spend those savings to appreciate what you have accumulated. Instead, the smart thing is to do what you can right now to maximize fitness. And so this idea applies to humans as well, where saving isn't always the wisest strategy.
And so that's a fast life history strategy, and that's adaptive. So it's adaptive in dangerous environments. And then slow strategies, they're for safer, more predictable environments. And you give the example of fast strategy being a rabbit that has lots of offspring, or that's not, you gave another kind of jungle animal, I forget, but I know about rabbits. They have a lot of offspring really fast. Some will die, some will get eaten by the coyotes. And then the slow strategy is elephants with this massive size, protects them from predators. It takes them a very long time to have offspring and for those offspring to reach maturity. They're late bloomers.
Right. So think about this. There being fast strategies and there being slow strategies. And you can see this across the animal kingdom where some animals, they grow very quickly, and within weeks sometimes they start reproducing, and when they do, they have these giant litters of 10, 20, 30 offspring immediately. They're not thinking about tomorrow. They're thinking about the present. And then you have other critters, like elephants or us humans, who wait years and years before reproducing. And sometimes we can reproduce, and we don't. We delay reproduction. And then when we do have offspring, we have one, and then maybe years later we might have another one. It's a very slow strategy.
And they're very well, they're more well cared for. And late bloomers that grow up less rapidly, they start puberty at later ages and actually seem to age biologically at a slower rate, where the people on the fast track, so somebody maybe who grew up in poverty in a dangerous neighborhood, they start puberty at earlier ages and they actually seem to age biologically at a faster rate.
Right, where a fast strategist, I mean, your body is literally going at a faster rate because it's trying to maximize the now rather than thinking about being here in the future.
And you talk about this very fascinating work from Bruce J. Ellis and Jay Belsky. They're developmental psychologists, and they found that two aspects of a childhood environment are critical in determining whether you have this fast life history strategy or slow, and it's whether you grow up in a dangerous environment and a fluctuating environment. So you could live in Beverly Hills but be a child of divorce and get moved around, and it seems like you would have then a fast life history strategy where you're more promiscuous, more risk-taking.
Right. So the key here is that it's not just that some animals are fast and some animals are slow. It's that within a species, some individuals are fast and some individuals are slow. So within us humans, some people are faster, some people are slower. And part of this comes from our genetic makeup, comes from our mothers and fathers. But the much more interesting part, to me at least, is that it's not all about your genes. Part of it has to do with your very first 5 years of life, which serves as a blueprint for how your mind thinks the world is going to look like when you grow up. And if those first 5 years you're surrounded by a lot of danger and a lot of unpredictability, that shunts you down this fast trajectory saying, well, when I get older, I'm going to make the most of what I have right now. But if your first 5 years is predictable, if it's not very dangerous, then it shunts you down this slower strategy where you're much more future-oriented and much more likely to save for the future.
Actually, you and your colleagues did this amazing research where you found that the experience of living in a fluctuating environment during preschool years was the strongest predictor of having more sexual partners, being more aggressive and delinquent, and having a criminal record as an adult. And it seems what you've done research on, and a lot of this chapter, in fact, points to why divorce is so bad for kids, because even if the parents are not really horrible to each other, the instability seems to really be detrimental, especially if it happens during your preschool years.
I mean, what was amazing to me about it when we were doing this study, which we had tracked people over 35 years, and we had information about their childhood, not just since birth, but even before their birth. And then year after year, we had information of what their life is like. And what we find is that those first 5 years seem to be critical, especially instability in the home, exactly what you're talking about. Now, whether that's divorce or it's just an unpredictable environment, you don't know when you're going to have dinner, you don't know if there's going to be food on the table. First 5 years of life, think about that. You might not even be processing as a little child that kind of information, but at some level, your brain is registering it. And that childhood is serving as a blueprint for you, where when you grow up, you say, okay, here's what I expect life to be like. You can't really trust people. You don't know where things are going to come from. And that's the kind of world in which my brain is preparing me to live in and to thrive in.
And fascinatingly, some of your other research, you found that growing up in a stable environment really helps you cope when it's exposed to stress. You gave people these sort of calming news articles or really stress-producing ones. And what happened?
Well, what's also interesting here is that when you grow up in these stressful or unstressful childhoods, so predictable or unpredictable childhoods, sometimes as an adult, you can't figure out who's the fast strategist, who's the slow strategist. People look like they're doing quite well. Maybe they're not spending in any different type of pattern. But to really figure out your true colors when it comes to fast or slow strategists, it shows up when people are stressed out. When people are feeling that their life is getting to them right now, and it's uncertain in their environment, maybe the economy is collapsing around them, maybe there are terrorist attacks being reported on the news, that's when they revert back to those childhood blueprints of fast and slow strategists, where people who grew up in unpredictable environments, they're willing to take very risky actions, they want immediate gratification, and the people who grew up in much more predictable early life environment, they're much more cautious, and they're thinking about the future because they expect to be around in the future.
Just makes me think, if I were a parent, I'd have breakfast be at the exact same time every day. I mean, it's just so interesting what this research points to about what you can do to maybe help your kids be a little more secure and a little more slow life history, if that's, again, as you say, it can be inappropriate for an environment, but to really provide stability seems extremely important.
I just actually saw a study the other day where looking at these kinds of variables, and what they found is that what time you go to bed each night, and not whether it's early or late, that part is not what's critical. What's critical is that it's the same time every night, that it's associated with stability, it's associated with a stable and consistent pattern. That's what's going to be predictive of a slow life history strategy.
Well, that's just so fascinating. When we come back, we'll talk about conspicuous consumption and status. This is Amy Alcorn's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking with evolutionary psychologist, psychology, and marketing professor, Dr. Vladas Griskavicius. His book, co-authored with fellow evolutionary psychologist Dr. Doug Kenrick, is The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think. And so let's talk about, in the specter of what you're talking about with our evolved psychology, conspicuous consumption. Where do we hold on to myths about status display?
Well, a lot of Americans engage in a lot of conspicuous consumptions. We spend, as a culture, over $500 billion each year on expensive brands, on luxury products that, to show it off. And a question that people have asked is, well, why is it the case? Why are people doing this? And what people have looked at said, well, it must be the television, must be this American media perpetuating this desire for flashy things. And the more closely you look at that, the more that you see that's actually not the real answer. If you took a Darwinian perspective and you took the Darwinian lens and pointed it at this puzzle, what you realize is that long before American culture, people have been engaging in all sorts of conspicuous consumption, whether it's kings wanting golden thrones or even in more traditional societies, people showing off their wealth. It's something about human nature rather than about Western media that's leading us to conspicuously consume.
And also there's status display when buying things that aren't the gold-plated blah, blah, blah. And, for example, hybrid cars. And you talk about the, are they helping the environment or going green to be seen?
Right, where I was involved in a study a few years ago where the puzzle we're looking at is why are people spending so much money on all these green and pro-environmental products, like the Toyota Prius, which has sold over 1 million cars in the U.S. Alone. And if you ask people why they do it, the overwhelming majority gives the same answer. I want to help the environment. I'm doing it for the environment. I'm trying to be a nice person. But what we found in the study is that that's not necessarily the underlying reason why people are engaging in pro-environmental behavior. Instead, what we find is that it might be much more linked to people's status motives and their desire to show off their status. Because a lot of green products, especially in communities like Boulder, Colorado, or other places, San Francisco, that might value these kinds of products, it's a status symbol much more so than it is people's desire to be nice to others. People are going green to be seen rather than to actually be genuinely helpful.
And it helps to know that it's a status display because then you can decide whether or not you really want to pay for the Prius because you're probably not going to save that much money on gas if you don't drive a whole lot, for example.
Right. There's actually lots of studies showing that you don't save that much money on gas if you drive, say, a Prius as opposed to a Honda Civic. And to the premium you pay on the Prius, which is $5,000 to $7,000 premium, it takes you something like eight and a half years to recoup that premium in terms of gas savings. So the question is, why are people willing to pay that extra $5,000 to $7,000? And there's an easy answer to that. It's because they're getting a status boost. The people around them are perceiving those people in a different light. When they have a Prius parked in their driveway, as opposed to, say, something like a Hummer parked in their driveway.
Right. In L.A., that can get you in a lot of trouble. And one other display, another form of display is tipping. And this is so fascinating. You say that both sexes become big tippers when their mating subcells are primed for different reasons, that men want to seem like they have ample resources and women want to leave a little extra money to seem like they have a caring nature.
Right. So we did a study looking at why men and women engage in charity behaviors or just engage in where they give money and to others to appear helpful. I'm saying, well, what is this related to? And from an evolutionary perspective, oftentimes it boils down to something's probably related to mating. It's like that peacock's tail. The reason that peacock has such a large tail and wants to show it off is it because it helps its mate. It doesn't help the peacock survive. It helps it attract possible mates. And so what we found is that when people have a desire to attract a mate, even if it's a subconscious desire to attract a mate, they become better tippers. Both men become better tippers and women become better tippers. They leave more money on the table. But there's a little bit of a twist to that, where the reason why men and women do that is not quite the same. Where what women are doing there is they're trying to say, look how nice I am. Notice, I care about the person working there. You know, that server doing a hard job, I want to be nice, I'm going to leave a larger tip. For the guys, being nice, not nearly as important. What is more important for the guy is to say, look how much money I have. I can give away lots of money, give it away on tips, It's not that I really care about the server and want to be a better person. I want everyone, especially the people who are at the dinner table that night, to see how much money I can spend on tipping other people.
Now, you have some great advice in this book about how not to get taken for a ride. And you talk about how people use our sub-selves. And just talk again what our sub-selves are. They use our sub-selves to parasite off of us.
Well, think about being in a situation where you're about to buy something and you're going to spend a lot of money, and it seems like the greatest thing in the world right there and then. Now, maybe you're about to fork over $3,000 on an engagement ring. Maybe you're about to buy a nice vacation. It just seems so wise at the time. And then you wake up the next morning and you regret it and say, oh, that was such a waste. That was so much money I spent on that thing, and I don't really need it. Well, what's going on is at the time when you're purchasing that thing, that purchase is aligned. Some marketer has aligned that purchase with your evolutionary goal. If your goal is to get engaged, to attract a person of the opposite sex right there in that second, that engagement ring will look like a great purchase. Well, the next morning, you might have a different goal on your mind. And from that different perspective, that ring wasn't a good purchase at all. So one of the important pieces of advice here is that you always want to sleep on important decisions and let the rest of your psychology weigh in on that important decision, where it's not just being driven by only one evolutionary goal.
And I just wanted to give a few of these sub-selves. There's a self-protection sub-self, the disease avoidance sub-self, the status sub-self, the mate retention sub-self. These are some of them. The affiliation sub-self, that's the team player. And so, yeah, this great idea. You say that imagine a mental Rolodex filled with photos of your best friend, your spouse, your children, someone you find sexy, someone who scares you, someone who is sick, that would bring out the disease avoidance sub-self, or someone you really admire, and have those sub-selves weigh in on your decision to spend. Are you really going to spend your entire year's salary on a car?
Right, absolutely. Think about the classic situation in which a guy might be enticed to commit adultery. So he's a married man with children, and maybe he's a high-status person, and has a flock of women around him, and they're interested in him. Well, at that moment, you might desire to engage in some kind of a relationship with that woman, because the goal on your mind is to attract the opposite sex, attract a mate. Well, if in your mind you start thinking about your children, you start thinking about your family, you are changing your current evolutionary goal. You're shifting it from attracting a mate to caring for your family. And when your goal is caring for your family, all of a sudden that opportunity to have an affair is not going to look nearly as attractive, because it does nothing to serve your goal of caring for your family. And by having this Rolodex in your mind, you can change what your current evolutionary goal is and avoid making some really poor decisions.
I love that you have sort of a conference room full of selves. I mean, that's very helpful instead of being all on your own. And so another bit of advice you give is that this hard-bitten rational self-interest is not always in your self-interest. And that sometimes treating people more like family. And you say actually earlier in the book, I forgot to bring this up, we have relationships with people who sell us groceries or automobiles, that we actually, these people become people we have relationships with. And to do that with people, that this can make these transactions and interactions go better.
Well, one of the most ironic scientific findings that I have seen is that when people play economic games in studies, and this usually involves you're given some money and you have to make an offer to another person, and your goal is to end up with as much money as you can. And so people play this and they use all kinds of strategies. One of the greatest ironies is that the people who tend to do worse at these games are students who are trained in economics. Students who are trained in the same way that a lot of business schools, the kind of business school I work, train people to function as in life. to behave rationally, to try to maximize self-interest. And at the end of the day, rational self-interest is not always in your self-interest. Just like in the case of Southwest Airlines we talked about earlier, where if everyone treated each other in a self-interested, rational manner and try to get the most while they can in that situation, Southwest Airlines might not even be around today. It's because they're treating each other more like a family, willing to do more of a give and take, that they succeed as a whole, succeed as a group.
Yeah, and it's worth reading about their business and how that's happened. And so we're almost out of time. Last but not least, you say don't assume other people who seem to make sort of idiotic decisions are morons. You say look for the deeper evolutionary roots behind their decisions.
Right. Whenever you see anything puzzling out there, in the same way that Darwin looked at the peacock's tail and saw a puzzle, if we see puzzling behavior, usually there's much more to it than meets the eye. And somewhere hidden in there is your evolutionary ancestral brain trying to maximize fitness, trying to do something that would have worked well for our ancestors.
Thank you so much. This has been such a great show. I've been talking with Dr. Vladas Gustavicius. His book, co-authored with fellow evolutionary psychologist Dr. Douglas Kenrick, is The Rational Animal, How Evolution Made Us Smarter Than We Think. Vlad, thank you so much. It's been great.
Thank you for having me.
You know what's great about the Volkswagen Sign and Drive event? No matter how you sign your name, you can get a great deal on select 2018 Volkswagen models. Sign perfectly neat, you get a great deal. Sign super messy, get a great deal. Sign outside the lines. Do one of those fancy weird signatures where your nine-letter last name looks like a half a V. You still get a great deal on models like the all-new Tiguan SUV or fun-to-drive Jetta. So practice your signature. Then head over to your nearest Volkswagen dealer for the Sign and Drive event, going on now for a limited time. You know what's great about the Volkswagen Sign and Drive event? No matter how you sign your name, you can get a great deal on select 2018 Volkswagen models. Sign perfectly neat, you get a great deal. Sign super messy, get a great deal. Sign outside the lines. Do one of those fancy weird signatures where your nine-letter last name looks like a half a V. You still get a great deal on models like the all-new Tiguan SUV or fun-to-drive Jetta. So practice your signature. Then head over to your nearest Volkswagen dealer for the Sign and Drive event, going on now for a limited time.